Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew Podcast. Leave us a rate and review. And visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. This week, we watched American Fiction, directed and written by Cord Jefferson. American Fiction is a 2023 American comedy drama film written and directed by Cord Jefferson, as I said before, in his feature directorial debut. It is based on the 2001 novel Erasure by Purcell Everett. The film follows a frustrated novelist slash professor who writes an outlandishly stereotypical Black book, a satire only for the book to be published to high sales and praise. This movie stars Jeffrey Wright, Tracy Ellis Ross, Issa Rae, Sterling K. Brown, John Ortiz, Erica Alexandra, Leslie Uggams, Adam Brody, and Keith David. So, Dale, what were your thoughts about this movie?
I thought it was an amazing movie. I was interested in it before when the initial trailers and stuff were coming out, and I found it more apropos after last week watching FD's video on this kind of same subject matter and topic. So I thought it was very funny that I watched it right after that. I loved the project. Well, this movie hits on a lot of themes and topics I do think are things that we've discussed personally in this circle of this podcast and that led to the creation of this podcast and talking about movies and stuff. But yeah, I enjoyed like every minute of it, you know.
Yeah. I remember you talking about this film before it came out, and I was like, oh, what's this? And then I was seeing that it was getting such good reception, and I was like, oh, okay, well then, I gotta check it out if everyone is saying it's, like, really good. But yeah, I really enjoyed this movie. I thought it was incredibly refreshing and honest. Again, it hits on a lot of things that we have been talking about on this podcast for years. And send me the link to the FD video, because I actually do want to see that. But yeah, I think that there are two storylines of, one, a man writing what he thinks Black audiences want, really out of the necessity of money, and also being a caretaker for his aging mother, were beautifully woven together. It was incredibly personal to me, I guess, in my current situation, but also just like any Black artist, I feel like can totally relate to everything that this movie is saying. So
yeah. Yeah, like I love, like, it's so layered and nuanced beyond like the paradoxical, not the paradoxical, the satire of how Hollywood and white liberals tend to view Black culture. Like, they love the auspices of Black culture, but not the actual Black people. It kind of does hammer the point perfectly home at the end when they're talking about selecting the book for the award, and the white lady's like, oh, some, it's important. I think sometimes they have those dope Black voices. When the two Black authors are like, this book is trash, we don't want it, we don't like it. I love subject matter. Like, it reminded me of like a couple years ago, we have like Nancy Pelosi and all the senators wearing scarves, wearing scarves and kneeling down in honor of, you know, Juneteenth or whatever. Those kind of performative white gestures that, you know, white people think makes them allies when that kind of behavior doesn't, and intermingles with all this, you know, racial, how's the word I would describe, racial gymnastics on perception. Mm-hmm. There is a love story in it with their, I guess, their house helper and the neighborhood security guard, which I did like as well.
Yeah, that was cool. And Jeffrey Wright gets his own love story with, it's Erica Alexander, right?
Yeah.
From living, or is it? It's Living Single, right?
Yeah.
Because there's another show that's
Living
called
Color. Living was Color. It's a comedy show. Yeah.
Two different things. But I remember when I saw her, I was like, I know this woman. Where is she from? I couldn't believe, I haven't seen her on screen in such a long time. Like, I didn't even know she was still acting, but apparently she's doing like things here and there. But that was great. I loved seeing her. That kind of made my whole day. But
her character is also a lawyer, just like in the show and everything.
The show, it's so cute. It's so cute. But yeah, I get it's so interesting of like coming into this space, I guess, or in recent times where it's like, how do we as Black people make art, right, that is true to our experiences, that don't fall into stereotypes, but how will that be received by wider audiences, like people who might not just be Black and who are like interacting with the work? Because the thing that I loved the most, which is interesting because I had friends who had watched this and they said they loved the movie, but they didn't like the ending. Mm. I felt like the ending was really good because it doesn't answer certain questions that I think it does pose, because there aren't any concrete answers to those questions yet. Like, do you stop making the slavery movies, you know, the movies, the eighth movie about Martin Luther King Jr.? Like, and do you make a movie like Get Out or Moonlight or something like that, where you're like telling new stories about, you know, what has already been happening in the Black culture, but hasn't really been kind of shown to wider audiences? Like, how do you split the difference? Like, how do you make a movie that is interesting and nuanced about the Black experience and have it be received when it's not just Black people watching the movie? And I think one of the things that they point to in this film early on is when he's speaking to his, Jeffrey Wright's character is speaking to his editor, and he's like, you know, you're writing amazing books, but like, because you're a Black person, people kind of want a certain kind of book from you, right? Yeah. And you can do all of these things, but it's like, one is going to get more attention, going to get the readership, going to get the money, and the other ones aren't. And it's like, okay, so what does that mean? And him and Jeffrey Wright and Issa Rae have this conversation at the end of like, what is the right way to kind of do it? And it kind of, and there are no answers. And I really like that that's how the film leaves you. Like, they don't know, I don't know. What is, who's to say like, what's the right thing to do? I don't know.
Yeah, like in FD's video, he mentioned, you know, of course, the trials of Spike Lee being one of the preeminent Black filmmakers, and, you know, when his stuff got too Black, in other words, too Black to where white people, it was compatible to white people, it wasn't the things white people wanted to see, he wasn't receiving the necessary funding, and he created a movie called Bamboozled, which kind of delves with this kind of issue in a way. You had a black person in a position of authority, you know, he had white people that he worked with who assumed that they knew Black culture, like Michael Rapaport's in the movie. And he also mentioned that's funny knowing how Michael Rapaport is now, yeah. You know, and he's like, oh, I'm the down white boy kind of thing. But in Bamboozled, the lead character played by Damon Wayans is kind of like a Black person who's trying to erase his identity. And in order to make money, he's making like a minstrel show. And because he sees the money in it, he doesn't really care. And that's kind of like the ending argument that kind of both Issa and Jeffrey Wright's character kind of give. Mm-hmm. And she's, which is kind of like, if white people are buying it, it's okay because we're not a monolith and I actually did research. And I do think her character's point, both characters make good points, but I do feel like she loses they both kind of lose by saying, oh, you view our potential as something we don't have. And which she is correct. You view the lack of our potential that we're not meeting as a negative. And she also says, oh, I researched it. It's not a life I lived. And because I researched it, it makes my parody of Black culture okay. You know, they both made very compelling arguments, but their last two closing statements failed theoretical levels, I think, on the concept of Black identity and how should we portray it in media.
Yeah. I feel like it is very complicated because it's like, again, it's like, well, if people don't know the history of a certain Black figure who did all these wonderful things, isn't it our duty to showcase that story? But if the media that everyone is consuming is just about the Black struggle and overcoming those struggles, even though, you know, a lot of those things still have not been overcome, do you want to keep showing that as the definitive kind of perspective of like what black the black experience is. Because if you're trying to do something different, then you should. Like, we need those stories too. And I think, I don't know, I guess my personal opinion is that sometimes those stories are a little bit more important just because it gives people a much more broader sense of like who we are. Because we already know what the perspective is. We already know what the stereotypes are. We already know what that is. We've seen that multiple times throughout the years. So not that those things aren't valuable, but we also need a more expansive look at what who we are. And we could have both of those things together, but I think we have to challenge, I think what's important is to challenge some of those perspectives, especially because a lot of the time those films weren't made by with black voices. They were made by other people's interpretation of what the black experience was not being black. And so I think there is like also like a reclaiming our own identity and showcasing that. So it is, I can see what her point of view was, like you were saying, like I get where she was coming from, but I also think that, I think it's a little too easy to feed into things that people already know.
Yeah.
And that it's actually more difficult and by that way, a little bit more important to do something completely different. Yeah, I think that's my thoughts on the and that conversation.
Yeah, and I like the thought that came to my head of watching this movie, you know, was the fact that it's not lost on me that the seminal modern day classics of, you know, black entertainment are Snowfall, like modern classic, The Wire, modern classic, and, you know, 50 Cent's power stuff, modern classic, kind of all delving around black people, you know, drug dealers, all that kind of things. And those are considered modern classics of entertainment. So the issues kind of discussed in the book are still happening, you know, in the issue. So, yeah.
And that's why they were eating it up. That's why they loved it. Yeah. That's why I love this movie, because it was so like the white people were eating it up, like really eating all of the like classically stereotypical, you've seen this a billion times. What my perception of like what black struggle looks like as a person who isn't, you know, black, just eating the whole thing up and loving it. And like, again, to that point, to your point, when they were discussing the book prize winners, and they were like, we're going to center black voices, but not your voices,
not yours,
our interpretation of like what needs to be centered. Like, it's just like, do you see the irony? And some people were saying that, like, the people were laughing in their theater, and it was just white people. And I was like, not that the black people weren't laughing, but it just was, like, an uncomfortable laughter of, like, oh, you're calling us out. Isn't that awkward?
it's very, when you mentioned Get Out, it's very much the white dad in Get Out was like, oh, I would have voted for Obama, you know, a second time if I could. It's very much that white liberal, you know, mentality. I'm not listening to what you're saying. I'm going to inference what I think, you know, is. But back to the movie itself. Let's go beyond. I really wish, and it's because it's based on a novel, I wish Tracy Ellis Ross's character got a little bit more time, because I did love hearing both Jeffrey Wright's character and hers and Sterling K. Brown talking about the upbringing as kids. I can kind of understand that archetype of, you know, three siblings. And I feel like Tracy reminds me a lot, like their dynamic is Tracy kind of bounces between the two. Like if you know anybody with three siblings, there's always the middle one who kind of bounces off and has a good relationship, where the other two are on opposite spectrums. And I really love that, you know, showcasing that. And it also showcases how certain children have different experiences with their parents, and their interpretation of their parents are drastically different as well.
Yeah, that's what made this film to me like A+, is that we had the personal story of Monk, the character of Monk played by Jeffrey Wright, and his siblings and his caretaking of his mother. Because I feel like we talked about the art side of it, but to talk about the family side of it, I totally agree that I did not like the fact that Tracy Ellis Ross dies in the first like 30 minutes. I was like, are you kidding me? Why? Like, I mean, I guess it is based on a book, so I guess it had to happen. But like, I was waiting for her to be a part of this whole thing. With that said, Sterling K. Brown, star of the show, like literally every scene he was in, he ate it up. Like, it was so good. But yeah, it's so true to what you're saying of like how each kid experiences that either their parents or their childhood in very different ways. And I also have two siblings. I actually have four. Yeah, I have three. There's four of us. But you lost count. I have a half sibling. So like the three of us from the first marriage, very different experiences of things and also a lot of similarities. I feel like as I'm getting older, I realize that like we have all been affected by certain things the exact same way. Yes. It comes out differently in all three of us because we all had different personalities, but like, yeah, the same things are affecting us in that same like pressure point, those same like really like big things that maybe as a kid you don't talk about because you don't have the language to kind of explain it, but like as you get older you're like, oh, okay, yeah, we were all in it at the same time. So I really enjoyed the dynamic of that, and so I was sad when she left because I did feel like there was like a missing piece to that family dynamic and that missing perspective that I definitely wanted to see more of, because it seems like before Monk comes back home she is taking care of the mom exclusively. Sterling K. Brown's character of Cliff is not even around. He's going through his own situation, and you know that's kind of what happens as you become adults. Everyone kind of goes off and lives their own lives, but then you know your parents get older and then you have to figure that out. Like, how are you gonna all take care of your aging parents? So it's like, and it's such a weird thing because I think, is Monk the youngest or was Tracy Ellis Ross the youngest?
It's kind of hard. I do think, to me, I think how I have it in my head is Tracy's probably the oldest, I think.
Yeah.
And Monk being the youngest, just on the fact of his closest with the mother, anyway. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now he like adored his dad and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's the youngest. And when you're the youngest, you don't hold a lot of responsibility when you're growing up. Like that's your older siblings. They kind of bear the brunt of that. But then if something happens, like when your older sibling isn't around or they can't take care of your parents, you have to step up. And so there's an interesting thing of like feeling, because you're the youngest, you were always taken care of, and there was like a distance, like, oh, he in the beginning he doesn't even want to go back home, like he doesn't want to deal with his family, and then he ends up being the main caretaker, and that really was like, I don't know, that kind of hit me. I was like, yeah, that's true. It's like somehow you end up being the person doing it, and it's scary, but also like you do feel like a new kind of like an unlocking of like, okay, I didn't even know I was capable of doing this, because again, that's not how you grew up. So yeah. Taking on that role, it does feel like a complete shift in your life. It's very interesting. I was in the theater like, yeah, it was very emotional in yeah, a weird
like,
way.
He's like when they're talking, he's like, what should we do? He's like, you can make the choice. You're the oldest one here. You make the decision. And he's like, oh, I wasn't aware that you're paying for, you know, everything, even with your divorce and losing half your income in the divorce. You're taking care of everything. He was in for a shock. Like, both the other brother was, you know, was in Tucson, living enough, discovering his, you know, self-identity as a gay man now. You know, he's there in L.A., you know, teaching and writing and pissing off, once again, young white liberals who gets mad at seeing the N-word on the chalkboard. And she can't disassociate, you know, the lesson that's being taught. She's mm-hmm. like, I don't like that word. It's bad. It's like, if I got over it as a black man in this context, you can get over it as well. You know, he's dealing with all that like so discredited from school, what's going on at home, and I think that's why he always viewed being home as, like we said, because our perceptions of our parents and our upbringing is different. That's why he always viewed home as a negative, thing for him. Because he, like the mother says it, and like you don't know how to, you're just like your father. You don't know how to connect with people, on a certain way. So that's why home was always hell. And through the movie, he's also discovering that, because when he says, after their helpers wedding, he's like, him and his brother talking, he was like, I've been getting angry a lot. I feel like I'm like dad. Like, he's realizing as much as his affection for his father, he has picked up his negative traits. And I can say, me personally, I see that too. Like, there are things, like, there are times where I'm chilling with my dad. Like, we were driving at one point, and literally, I kid you not, we both, like, put our hands behind the armrest at the same time. And he would be like, cop, and says, nope, not copying you. And my mom will say, you're just like your father if I do this, like, if I pick up on some of his tics. Like, as we get older, we're suddenly become cognizant that we are literally copycatting our parents. And sometimes we decide to actively rebel against it and do better. Like, depending on your influence of your parents, sometimes they say, I'm going to improve it, or, you know, you are a good example, I don't mind imitating you. And I think that's also the battle he's dealing with as far as his empathy. Because his sister even says, you make smart remarks in forms of questions to make it seem like you're not making a smart remark. Mm-hmm. Those kind of things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was so good. And just like how you view yourself and your family, and then like the traits that you take on from your parents without even knowing it. It's like, oh, I'm acting that way. I think one of the things that was interesting for me to watch was that he was discovering things about his parents that he never knew and everybody else did. And so for him, it was just like a shock. It was like, oh, dad was having affairs? Like, what was going on? And it was so interesting because it seemed like for most of his life, he was trying to like run away from his family. Like, he moved to the other side of the country. Like, he seemed to do something completely opposite than when his other siblings, you know, both of his siblings were in medicine and he decided to become a writer. So it's like he was in, I think, what, like, in a rebelling against whatever he was growing up with, and then having to return and facing all of that stuff. Kind of as an embittered person, I feel like his experiences, I think when you're always reacting against something, it never ends up being the thing that you want. Yeah. And so coming home was actually like not only him present, like physically coming back to his house, but like coming home and coming into himself or finding a new piece of himself, because he was facing death and his aging parent and this book that was a joke blowing up, and also finding love. And so it was like a coming of age story, but for an adult. And I think that I love stories like that, because it shows that you're always growing. Like, that you don't reach a point where you have everything figured out. And I actually love when they choose to have that a coming of age story for older people, because like, I feel like I've heard that from older people too, where it's like they're in their 40s and they're just now starting to do the thing that they've always wanted to do their whole lives and stuff like that. You know, they had the kids, they had the marriage, and now they get to kind of be their own person and discover their own kind of dreams and stuff. And I'm like, that's great. We need more stories like that. Cause I just feel like, you know, you don't come of age when you're like 18 and then that's it. Like, you're just figuring things out at that point. And there's so much time between then and, you know, middle age. So.
Yeah. I really vibe with it. And I guess now, because I am closer to that point than you are since this January. But yeah, I vibe with it so much. I have a personal opinion of, everybody kind of grows and changes like 5-year spurts. And the person you are now wasn't the person you were 5 years ago, and so on and so forth. It's gradual maturity and change. And I think that's also why he like always felt home was negative. Because like you said, he was always running away from home. He doesn't know anything that's going on happening at home. Doesn't know about his father's affairs. Doesn't know any of that. And they're like, they basically told him, oh, because you love dad. Mm-hmm. And you disconnect from everybody else. So yeah, I think this story, or this picture, this novel really hits at a lot of things. Like, the subject matter and the content in it is just so enormous. I like Sterling K. Brown being messy as all hell as he discovers himself, not giving a damn at all. Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of things. Yeah,
and he's also coming of age too in a weird way, because now he's like living in his truth. And it's messy in the beginning, right? Like, it's, you don't have everything together when you just like finally accept it. And I love that conversation that they have at the end where he was like, you know, do you wish that dad was still here and you could tell him, you can come out to him. And he was like, you know, I really do. I wish that he was here so I can tell him. And Monk is saying, you know, but what if he rejected you and like didn't accept who you were? He was like, well, at least I would have known. And I just thought that that was so, yeah, that was so moving just because it's like, you really don't, it's so interesting when people, when you lose people, even if they're still alive, but they're not really there, they're not in your life anymore. It does feel like there's, as you get older, there's so much more stuff that you want to connect with them with, connect with them on, even though, you know, their views might have been different. They probably might not have been cool with it or whatever, or who you are or what you chose to do in your life. But just having that connection actually is so important. I think that's what I found in this movie as I was watching it. I was like, now that I'm older, I really want to like reconnect with my family. Like I really want to hang out with them and spend time with them. Like just thinking about it makes me very happy. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just like, as you age, you just realize that life really is super short. And at any point, any of us can go. And you just want to make the most out of, you know, those moments that you have left. Yeah. Again, it's so funny because this movie is kind of about challenging stereotypes, but it's more about just like our humanity. And I just think it's getting praised for all the right reasons because this movie really is exceptional. I do think it's one of the best that came out of last year.
And I think you kind of hit the underlying theme of the movie is empathy and humanity. Like, of course, the white liberal not being identified to the Black experience only because they've only seen one aspect of the Black experience. That in itself is the only Black experience, you know, that there is. They can't see the humanity in Black people beyond that identity. You know, empathizing with your siblings, with your parents, like you said, like reconnecting with your family. Like there are times where I'll just randomly like bust up in my sister's room and just hug her, and then she'll pinch me like we're five. Like things like that. Like I couldn't imagine myself at like 15 doing that, like as we're arguing like cats and dogs, like throughout the house. Now I actively seek her out and I'll hug her and I'll say what's up and I'll like mess with her. Like and this the part that hit me the most is because is when they're in the nursing home and he's dancing with his mother and she says, "Oh, I always knew you weren't queer." And that hurt a lot because I remember that didn't hurt because I can't relate to the homosexual experience and not having, you know, the proper love for your family. But I remember when my grandmother was sick, and you talk about spending time with older members of your family as well. Like, I look back now, like, I got all this, you know, video recording equipment, and I never sat the time down to, like, record my grandmother and like, talk to her at all. And that's the thing that always circles in my head. So I think now, due to that, I kind of want to call it trauma of never doing that with my grandmother, because she was like literally my only grandparent left, you know. So now I kind of value the interactions I have, even though like family pisses each other off. I now value those experiences now, because I never know when I'm going to have another opportunity to create a memory, you know.
Yeah, that was that scene. Ah, that broke my heart. Because it's like, again, you don't, I think a lot of the times when you grow up in a certain kind of household, you're always searching for answers, approval. But like approval and a different experience. Like you want things, you want like what you would hope that your family life would be is the thing that you're always kind of chasing. Whether like consciously or subconsciously. And I feel like in that moment, he was like, I'm going to have this moment with my mom. I'm coming back home, Cliff. And like, and she knows who I am now. Maybe she knows who I am now. And maybe I can have this experience with her where we have this closeness that I've always wanted to have with her. And then she says something like that. Yeah. And then it's like, it's never going to happen, right? Like, so all the things you built up in your mind, hoping that could be different, like maybe in this moment it could be different, all of that is completely dashed. And it's like, he just leaves, right? And I was like, yeah, that's to me, that's like, that's real life. Yeah. Like, you're not always going to get the moments that you want. You're not always going to get the answers that you want. Sometimes it just doesn't work out. And you have to find peace with that, right? And you just have to live in your truth no matter what. Great storytelling. It's so good because it's so true to life.
Yeah, it's and that scene is touching because I think as your are like, we know our parents love you or love us or whatever, but it's also hits because as much as we think or we know our parents love us, and it kind of hits because sometimes they don't realize how the things they say and what they say, how it, a stranger on the street could have called them queer and gay, and he was like, whatever, fuck you, whatever, you want to throw hands, you want to fight. It doesn't hurt him the same way as when your parents say those same things to you. So I really like that whole scene was like, really like, damn, like I can get it. Like as an adult thinking, when you think back on your experience as a child, like, damn, I can see myself in that situation and reacting that same way, you know?
Yeah. He doesn't even argue with her. He just leaves. So good. Yeah. So good. I don't know what else to say other than fantastic movie. This movie was nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars, which is so amazing. And Sterling K. Brown got, I think, his first Oscar nomination. Overdue. He has been killing it for years. Like, he is just such a phenomenal actor. Like,
Jeffrey's in it for Best Actor. He's in it, and Sterling K. Brown's in it for Best Supporting Actor.
Amazing.
Amazing. And I'm these so are two proud. Two people who have had long careers, particularly Jeffrey Wright. You know, so like Sterling K. Brown has just come into prominence due to I forgot the name of that show now. That was my show. This Is Us. And he like just became into prominent kind of because of that show. But yeah. Well deserved. Like, we've been singing his praises in those kind of roles forever. Like forever. Like, we'll talk about Waves forever. This is one of those movies that is just like Waves that I can vibe with so much. So
So yeah, I'm really glad that this movie is getting the acknowledgement it deserves because it's just so fantastic.
Okay. Moving on to head, we did mention a while ago a bit of, you know, the Oscar nominees being picked. It was a lot of confusion going on. You know, if anybody has saw the shortlist, there are a lot of people who are on the shortlist who people have realized were kind of let off due to the Oscars. Some of the selections are a bit suspect. Some of them might be based just on pure box office numbers, not really on the strength of it. What are your biggest outliers for you personally with the Oscars as far as the nominees you've seen so far?
Okay, well, to be honest, I saw the list and thought, you know, this is pretty good. I interestingly this year did not have that many issues with the Oscar list as I usually do in previous years. So that's saying something. I don't know what it's saying, but it's saying something. I was disappointed that May December didn't get anything. I thought that everyone did a great job, especially Charles Melton. I think a lot of the young kids were rooting for him to get an Oscar nom. So that was kind of sad that that didn't materialize. But so I was kind of hoping for that. I thought T.O.U., who was in Past Lives, I thought he definitely deserved something for supporting actor. I thought that that should have been like an obvious thing, but. And also Celine Song for Best Director, but
yeah,
it's her first film, so I'm like, okay, you know. And then I think but other than that, I don't really know what America Ferrera was doing up there. But we'll talk about the Barbie stuff in a second. But go ahead and talk to me about your.
Yeah, I'm about the same. I do think she should have got in there for Past Lives, a wonderful picture. You know, like we've had a discussion, if a movie is nominated for Best Picture, why are the directors in the other categories? That kind of thing. I'm a little bit, I feel like with Best Actor, I'm still kind of figuring out how I feel about DeMille Coleman as in Rustin. I'm still kind of iffy about it. I feel either way about the movie. I don't think it was one of the best movies of the year. So maybe that's why I'm kind of wondering as to why his best actor selection was there. Of course, like I said, America Ferrera. And of course, you know, we can get into it. Well, before we get into it, best picture. I hate when the Academy splits up best animated and best picture, because me personally, I do believe that Into the Spider-Verse, even the last Spider-Man movie, both of those, you know, should have been up for best picture as well. You know, beyond animated, like I think even some animated features, you have The Boy Inherent, Elemental, Manoa, Robot Genius, Spider-Man, two or three of those could have been in the best picture category. I'm not a fan of the whole segmenting them and thinking animation is, like Guillermo says, it's a medium, it's not a genre, and the industry itself is not, you know, dissecting itself from that thought process at all.
Yeah, I think from these years of like combing over Oscar stuff, where like half of your year is dedicated to looking for movies that will be nominated, the actual nominations, who ends up winning. I think I'm understanding that, like, when it comes to certain categories, like, you can have a really good performance in a not so great movie. And I think I've seen that a couple of times where, like, the performance is great, but the movie itself was kind of meh. And so for on that, or I think, yeah, Coleman Domingo did a great job in Rustin. His performance was great. Now, was the movie good? Not really. Yeah. So that's the category he was nominated for, and that's what was in there. But I think the Oscars extended how many Best Picture nominations that they would have. I think it was shorter, not in recent times, but maybe kind of like back in the day, it was shorter. Like,
up to a couple of years ago, it was just five. Like, like every other category. Now this year, it's like 10.
And they extended it a few years ago. Yeah. So it's like, they're trying to give more space to more films, and I think that that's a really good thing to do. But the issue is that now you still have the same amount of nominations for directors. Because the idea is, well, if your movie is nominated for Best Picture, then the directors should be coherent. Like, it should be similar. But you still have, 10 nominees for Best Picture and only 5 nominees for Best Director. You know, obviously, all the things that have got nominated for Best Picture, their directors won't get nominated because there's just not enough space. So, like, I guess they have to figure out how they're going to do that, because there are times where it just kind of doesn't make any sense. It's like, well, how can you nominate the movie but not the person who put it together? It's like,
I love the fact that for international feature, like, of course, with France, you know, An Enemy of All was in that country selection, and the Academy was like, oh, put in the Best Picture.
So speaking about that, let's talk about Barbie. That's the main thing that's been, people have been very outraged about this. So Barbie was nominated for, I think, maybe 10 Oscars this year, including Best Picture. Margot Robbie was not nominated for Best Leading Actress, and Greta Gerwig was not nominated for Best Director, and people were screaming. What is going on? However, Ryan Gosling was nominated for Best Lead Actor, and America Ferrera was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. So what are your thoughts about?
First thought is, as the award season has gone on, Ryan Gosling has become more and more scared of the fact that he might actually sing I'm Not Ken at the Oscars, because you know, Best Original Song, he's probably going to end up paying it. And every time he wins an award from it, he looks like a deer caught in headlights. Like, what the fuck? Like, Greta's mentioned it. He's mentioned it was a joke song. It was never meant to be taken seriously. It was like last year with Jack Black with the Super Mario movie saying Peaches, Peaches, Peaches. That was the whole song, same category, a joke song that for some reason, people just like, oh, that song is amazing, and caught on to it. America Ferrera's nomination, I don't know. Best Supporting Actress. Nothing really wowed me per se about her performance. I do think they were just like, oh, we have to have somebody from Barbie there. Or if, you know, need Greta or, you know, or Margot is not there for director or actress, we have to put somebody in there for Barbie. I don't know. It's not a sexist thing. I just don't think her performance was amazing. And Barbie, to me, is like very paint by the numbers, you know. But Simo Liu did say something really interesting as far as Barbie. He mentioned all the stuff behind the scene that Margot and Greta were doing as far as, you know, getting the movie done. And somebody was like, what you describe is the job of a producer, which is correct. If I do think they should extend that circle for the awards to probably put producers a bit in there. Like, if you're going to perform on the workload that both Greta and Margot did to get this movie made, done, and shot and everything, I do think if there was a best producer kind of category for the Oscars, they would probably have ran away with it. Especially, I can see why she wasn't picked for best actress, because once again, we spent a lot of this time, this movie, with Ken. You know, they kind of split 50-50. She doesn't really take a big dominant role like she should be, I think. I'm kind of like the same issue I have with Lily Gladstone on a Kills Her Flower Mood. You know, as a lead actress in a story about her, she did not feature it a lot. So, yeah.
Okay. So, Barbie. I feel like the outcry has been mainly like, well, you know, Ryan Gosling got nominated, and that's just, it's just showing the message of Barbie correct, of like,
yeah,
Hollywood doesn't appreciate stories that center women. Now, I just want to say Barbie has 10 nominations for the Oscars. It's nominated for Best Picture. If Barbie wins Best Picture, Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie get Oscars. I hope everyone knows that. They might not, maybe because people don't watch the show, which is fine. Yeah. That's what happens when you win Best Picture. Since you're both producers, you both get Oscars. Now, the likelihood of that happening is slim. I think we kind of know what's going to win that night. But let's just say, for argument's sake, it did win. They would both go home with Oscars. So, like, we don't really need to be crying over the fact that they didn't get nominated for separate categories. Like, I think, all things considered, a movie about a doll getting this much nominations speaks to the quality of, like, you know what I'm saying? To me, that in itself is saying that this movie did something. You know what I'm saying? It had the desired effect, critically and commercially. Now, I think that we could have switched some things out. I didn't see Naiad with Annette Bening, so don't know what she did in that movie. I think Margot Robbie probably did deserve an Oscar nomination for this role, because to me, this was one of her best roles that she's done in her entire career. Like, you had nothing to work with, really. You're coming up with a character that is Barbie, and I think she did a great job in it. She was wonderful in that role. So, yeah, she could have got the nomination. Unfortunately, there were other performances that people just decided were stronger. And I can't say anything about that because I'm not in the nomination process. Mm-hmm. So I can't even, I don't know. Sorry. But Greta Gerwig not getting a nomination for the director. And I was saying this to my friends the other day. First of all, I don't think you can make a movie that's made for everyone that is good in the way, I don't know how to describe it, but good in the way of, like,
it attracts everybody.
It's groundbreaking and it's doing something completely different. I know in the article that I dropped here, which is by the BBC, they were saying that Barbie was so subversive. And to me, I don't think it was at all. As a woman, I did not find it subversive in the slightest. Like, the thing about Barbie, and I hate to say this because I feel like we talked about this in our Barbie review, but now that months have passed and I've watched it again, I think we have to come to a realization that although culturally it was a huge phenomenon and it made a whole bunch of money, it wasn't that good of a movie. It certainly wasn't Greta Gerwig's best film that she's done. This, to me, was her weakest film, actually. And it ended up being the thing that made $1 billion and people connected with in a huge way. And what I'm saying is that when you're making something for the mass public, it's not always going to be like the best work because you're trying to appeal to everyone. The issue with that is that, like, I think she was trying to do things that were flipping things on their head. However, if Mattel ends up being a huge character in the movie, which it did, you had the feminist for babies moment with America Ferrera trying to explain feminism to, I don't know, I guess men. We talked about that in our Barbie review.
Yeah.
And then you had the product placement. It's just like, to me, those were not good choices. And as a director, those are your choices. Like, you're making the choices to do that. And to me, that weighed the film down in a way that I don't think it needed to. I think that there was probably, like, it's kind of hard to, like, try to make a movie that talks about, you know, capitalism and feminism, but yet what you're depicting, you're selling, you know, Barbies for $50 now, and there is MAC Makeup doing a whole line that's surrounded about Barbie. It's like you're not really bucking the things that you're trying to criticize.
Yeah,
you're kind of going around in circles, semi-criticizing and semi-propping up those same ideas, which is what Barbie is doing. It's not, so in that way, it can't be subversive because you're not actually subverting anything. You're criticizing it a little bit, but yet you're also incorporating it into what you're doing. That doesn't make any sense. Those two things don't go together.
As much as I don't want to credit Amy Schumer, I do feel like... this version of Barbie is probably a more palatable version,
yes,
of the one she would have did. You know, she probably would have dealt with those same topics, and it kind of hits differently when you're dealing a woman who's not, the movie even says it itself, you know, talking about standards of conventional beauty. Our point is probably not accurately being illustrated by having Margot Robbie play Barbie. You mm-hmm. know, the movie is also self-aware that it can't really take itself seriously in the points it wants to make on feminism and how women are seen in society when your main star is Margot Robbie. You know, you kind of negate your main points in this movie by casting somebody of her level. So, yeah. I mean, they'll win if they win for Best Picture. And it felt very much like Transformers to me, and the fact that, looking back, this is a movie to sell toys. Mm-hmm. Like, look at the amount of marketing that went into Barbie. You know, they had life-size Barbie Playhouse. They, like, reproduced old catalogs of Barbies, you know, like we said with Greta's, you know, wardrobe choices. They really released some of those as collectibles. You know, toys were flying off the shelf at a rapid pace when the movie came out. Very much like Transformers. Like, Transformers was made by Hasbro to sell Transformers toys and their cartoon memorabilia. Very much the same wheelhouse to me.
So. Yeah. So it's like, and I think that's the main criticism is like, oh, it was so ahead of its time or whatever, and so critical of these things that, and it's like, but it wasn't though. So I guess people, the discourse to me is screaming white feminism to the nth degree. And listen, yeah. I love Greta Gerwig down. Like, I do. That's my girl. But you have to be honest. Like, Barbie was not one of our best films. I'm sorry. Yeah. Like, I know it hurts. It hurts me more than I think it hurts anyone else. I love her. I love Greta Gerwig so much. And it hurt me that I didn't really see... It was hard for me to really see her and I guess what I had come to know her for in a movie like this. And understanding that this is the direction she's going. She's not making Lady Bird anymore. Like, that's done. Like, that era of Greta is gone. Like, she's doing something. She wants to be female Steven Spielberg. That's her goal. And I'm like, do your thing, queen. But yeah. Like, you know, it's just, I feel like we have to be honest about yeah. what Barbie actually is. And then we can kind of reel it in with the, you know, outcry of, oh, this is unfair how the Academy has treated these people. Because I honestly feel like Justine Triet, who made Anatomy of a Fall, I think they were saying that she took her place. And to me, honest, like, and fairly so. Like, I don't get it. I guess I don't get it.
No, I understand what it is a lack of ignorance. People don't... Movies like Anatomy to Fall, like American Fiction, those movies mm-hmm. are not propped up in society as the ones we have to watch. Like, of course, everybody, Oppenheimer is one of the few outliers in that wheelhouse of how it's a cinematic masterpiece. Everybody has to watch it, you know, that kind of thing. And so, that's why they're saying she took her place without actually watching the movie. Because if you watch Anatomy of Fall, amazing project. And it also kind of hits the nail on white feminism when they ask Michelle Yeoh how she feels about Greta and Margot's.
Oh, what is she saying?
She said, "Oh, sometimes you're nominated, sometimes you're not." And it's kind of funny. Like she said something of that. And it's kind of funny. You're asking one of the few Asian women to get nominated for the award for her career and finally winning it. It's gives me very much flashback to last year for Best Supporting Actress, where Jamie Lee Curtis wins over
Angela Bassett.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Very much flashbacks over, like, if you want to nominate Jamie Lee Curtis, that's fine, but for that role, come on. You know, it's very much giving me, and it's also piggybacking on the fact that we have Lily Gladstone.
Yeah.
First Native American, I think second or third indigenous person. Mm-hmm. Because for Roma, she won as well and was nominated. So you have another underrepresented minority in the industry, an actual Native American, first time being nominated for an American award. Now that sounds like you say that out loud. You know, that's her first time, but we're complaining the fact that two other white women weren't selected for that category, you know.
Right. It's like the irony is not lost in me that, like, what y'all are upset about is completely discrediting the fact that I think this is the first time, maybe ever, that there was a person of color in every single category this year. Like, can we, and listen, I'm not about to be like, the Academy Awards are so diverse and, like, so ahead of the game. Like, no. Do you know how much work it took for people, for them to, like, wake up and actually get that message? Like, and they probably will reverse it and do some mess next year. So, like, this isn't congratulating the Academy Awards for literally doing the bare minimum. What I'm saying is that, like, what y'all are outraged for is just giving, like, our favorite white women didn't get a spot, and we're angry because in our minds, Barbie was so much more than it actually was. Like, I genuinely feel like there's a way that people have experienced that movie that I just didn't, and people who I know just didn't. So I can't understand why they're mad. Like, I just don't.
I can be mad because I think Fantasia probably shouldn't have been up there for Best Actress. She is not up there. You know, if you want to nominate Domingo Coleman, I wouldn't have done it probably for Rustin. Probably would have done it for his performance in Color Purple. You know, those kind of things. But
we could have moved some people around, you know. Like, I'm just saying, what I said in the beginning is how I feel. I feel like we could have moved Annette Bening out and put Margot Robbie in, but again, I didn't see the movie, so I don't know.
Part of her nomination is, like, she's kind of Hollywood worthy, married to Born Beatty, and she kind
of... I'm sure she's been nominated, like, a bunch of times
before. Well, no, for the Academy Awards, she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for The Grifters in 1990, and then she Best Actress in American Beauty, Being Julia and the Kids Are Right. So this is kind of like her fifth...
This is four.
Four for Best Actress, but she's kind of one of those feels like, oh, you've been in the industry long enough. You know that trope of you have a long career in the industry, you're never going to win your Oscar until you're near the end? It feels like that kind of thing for her. She's not going to win it for Dyad, but, you know.
No, right, exactly. So, like, why are we even, you know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't know. I feel like everyone had to be outraged about something, but I think in particular, people feel very fiercely about this movie because it was, like, unapologetically female and it did really well. But again, it's just like, you're congratulating, like, white women on making billions of dollars and the movie wasn't that great. So maybe just tone it down. Like, Hillary Clinton, I don't know if that actually was her tweet.
Oh my God. But if
she legit tweeted about this, it's like, girlfriend, we got to get you another job. Like, someone put her somewhere, because what the hell? Anyways, I'm done talking about this. Y'all can stay mad. We'll see you at the Oscars.
You'll see at the Oscars. Y'all still don't watch anyway, you know, so.
Right.
So we're going to move on to what we watched. I know you said you watched some selections from Sundance. What piqued your interest this festival season coming out of there?
Okay, well, first of all, I heard that Malia Obama did a short film, and I was like, oh my God, seriously? So I watched the short film program, not all of them, but mm-hmm. I watched a couple of films. And I watched hers, which is called The Heart. It was produced by Donald Glover, so it looked great. The story was a little shabby. It's giving like kind of like student film offering.
Yeah.
But she'll get there. She's just starting off, so she'll work it out. But I did love how it was filmed. It looked really good. And then I watched an actual film or a documentary, Frida, which is a documentary by Frida Kahlo, who I didn't know much about. I started watching the Frida movie starring Salma Hayek, but yeah. I didn't finish it because it was I was like, this feels weird. And then I realized that Harvey Weinstein produced it. And I was like, that's why I'm getting the ick. but then I actually watched this documentary and maybe I was getting the ick for no reason, because Miss Frida was on a different kind of wavelength. She was living her life like the woman was doing any and everything. And I love it. Like, I didn't know much about her. Like, obviously she's like a style icon. Like, her as an artist, her paintings have been like iconic throughout history. But I didn't know much about her. She is amazing. Like, and it was people kind of actors who kind of recorded her diaries and stuff. And then they were like, animated her painting. So it was like, you were hearing her words, obviously through an actor, but corresponding with her paintings and her relationship with another muralist, Diego Rivera.
Yeah.
Who I didn't know that she had this kind of longstanding relationship with, but she is a fascinating woman and kind of iconic, not kind of like iconic in the way that you think about her as like bucking traditional female stereotypes,
yeah.
Being bisexual, like just doing her own thing, like being an artist, not relying on men for money, like, and just her words of like how she understood and contextualized the world. This woman was on another level. Like, she was amazing, and I'm kind of obsessed with her now. So like, yeah, it was such a good documentary too. Like, it was really excellent. So there were other films that I wanted to see, but they're sold out, so I didn't get to see it. So maybe I'll see it when it comes out in theaters, but this documentary was fantastic. And then I rewatched Conversation with Friends, which is a adaptation of the Sally Rooney novel, which I'm also reading again. I read it in 2021 and I'm rereading again because I was just like, I need something to read because I'm bored. And then I watched the show again. I feel like kind of what, 20, so 3 years on, I have a very different perspective on the subject matter and on the show. It didn't do that well. It didn't do as well as Normal People did, but there's good stuff in there. And I feel like maybe we overlooked it for various factors. I mean, it wasn't Normal People, and like, I feel like Normal People is a much more digestible story than Conversations of Friends is, because Conversations with Friends is about like adultery and it's between like four people. So I guess it's kind of complicated to kind of get into it, but there's a lot of good stuff in there in the show and in the book. I feel like it was kind of underrated, and even I underrated it, because when I first watched it, I was like, this show sucks. And now I'm watching it again, and I'm like, nah, they got a point. Like, I see what they're doing here. So it's so funny. Sometimes, like, things, you just have to rewatch it again to maybe get a perspective on it. And maybe it does take, like, years and experience for you to look at things differently. And you can just go back to it. I think that's what the good thing about movies, books, television show, like, it hits differently at different spots in your life.
Yeah.
And when you look back on it, you're like, oh, okay, I see what this is. It takes on a new meaning, which is the wonderful thing about art. So
I know she has like a third book, Beautiful World. Do you think that's going to be adapted into like a series as well, or?
I don't know. I think maybe that was the plan, but because Conversations didn't do that well, I don't think they'll take a chance on it. I want to read it though. I want to see what that book's about. So, yeah.
Me personally, I did mention a while ago. You mentioned Sundance, it being Sundance season. I decided to rewatch a movie, one of my favorite films from a Sundance recent since we've been, you know, watching their stuff. We watched Flea. And it was very apropos as to what's going on in Gaza right now. Watching that, you know, documentary, you know, people leaving kind of situation, you know, during the one of the parts of the Cold War, leaving Afghanistan and trying to gain, you know, a safe spot in like Sweden and stuff, and a struggle of, you know, a refugee on that journey just looking for safety. And it's kind of funny the way, you know, politics work. You complain about refugees when your policies and the things you enact as a government create the refugee crisis that happen around the world. So you can't complain about it when you're also the cause of the problem. Yeah, a really moving picture. Yeah, still probably one of my favorite. And, you know, in looking at the credits, I was like, oh, this is like produced by Riz Ahmed. It didn't click when I watched it. You know, Riz Ahmed is also one of those guys who I love watching, supporting as a British actor when he gets opportunities to do these kind of things. So yeah, I loved it, you know. Still do.
I was thinking about that as I was watching the news every day, seeing what's going on. Like, yeah. Thank God this isn't a political podcast, because
I mean, we already kind of put it with the black stuff when it comes to movies. You don't want to.
But anyway, yes.
Before we cut, have you seen any recent trailers? Like, I saw Dev Patel's movie, Monkey Man, his directorial debut. Jordan Peele is producer for it. It was originally supposed to go to Netflix. And he was like, nah, this movie's too good. And he's like distributing it in films, which I love, because both him and Danny Kaluuya have their directorial debuts. You know, Danny Kaluuya got his break with Get Out and within the Kitchen on Netflix. You know, next year we're going to have, you know, Dev Patel, you know, his directorial debut, thanks to Jordan. I mean, yeah.
I haven't watched any trailers. I've been seeing them pop up, but I've been like, I feel like I've been still stuck on like all the stuff that I haven't watched yet, that I haven't gotten around to like watching the stuff that will be coming out this year. So I'm trying to finish up the last year, and then my mind will be in space. But yes, I'm excited for that. Okay, so we hope that you're all doing well. Make sure to check out all of our social media, support us if you can, and we will see you guys in the next episode. Bye.
Au revoir.